harping on the wars we fight and griping about the great things ought to be. And I don't mind you switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting men on the dying knee. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a fought and died. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be worn. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be worn. And you run down my country, man. You walking on the right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, this is Super Bowl weekend, and not very pleasant story. All this fall, the NFL has permitted its overpaid, in some cases, very unpatriotic players, some of them, has permitted them to kneel rather than stand for the national anthem. Well, there's some patriotic groups who would like to speak up about that. And first, the NFL rejected a print ad from a veterans group asking Super Bowl attendees to stand for the national anthem. Oh my gosh! Oh! Such a scary, frightening thought. Now the league and the NBC, the network broadcasting the game this Sunday, have rejected a TV ad from AML Bitcoin for being too political, according to the company. Well, what is too political, at least according to the NFL and NBC? The ad mocks North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un, with an actor portraying the despot as angry his hackers can't steal their cryptocurrency. Quote, we've been informed by our media buyers that the network carrying the NFL Super Bowl game, NBC, will not accept our television ad, North Korea can't steal AML Bitcoin, for placement during the broadcast. AML Bitcoin president Marcus Andrade wrote in a letter to NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, which the Daily Caller obtained a copy. Quote, an ad asking Kim Jong-un, the dictator of North Korea, taking Kim Jong-un, the dictator of North Korea, to task in a humorous and biting way should not be offensive to anyone, the letter continues, except perhaps the North Koreans. RAD reminds viewers that Kim Jong-un and his army of hackers have been stealing billions of dollars of Bitcoin and other digital currencies for the past few years, funding their rogue nuclear weapons programs and thwarting efforts by the rest of the world to sanction this behavior. And RAD points out that unlike other digital currencies, the AML Bitcoin has been designed with features that prevent this army from stealing it, which would seem like a perfectly legitimate advertising point or advertising claim. You really have to wonder about the... it's hard not to... not to see this as really anti-American. If this isn't enough to make you want to boycott Super Bowl Sunday and the NFL, then nothing will. This is from a veterans group. All throughout the season, the NFL allowed players to disrespect America, to include veterans, patriots of the military, and the police, rich people, players kneeling during the national anthem, and Beyonce's halftime show. Now the day of the Super Bowl game, and they insult, and they add insult to injury, a big slap in America's face. First, the NFL rejected a print ad from a veterans group asking the Super Bowl attendees to stand for the national anthem. Doesn't sound like a terribly radical thing. Now the league and NBC, the network broadcasting the game this Sunday, have rejected a TV ad mocking Kim Jong-un. I've just reported on that. And probably it would be a good idea to boycott it. Don't watch it. It's basically a great game of Negroes playing against other Negroes, as George from Baltimore, who was our co-host for a year and a half on the Trump phenomenon, said. And he was a great football fan from his youth, about 30, 40 years ago. He said, it isn't my game anymore. No longer represents who I am or who we are. It really is no longer a white person's game. So, why support it? I think that's a very good response. Hey, we don't have to support people who insult us and people who hate us. Don't have to do that. Another interesting, annoying thing here. And that is the Parliament in Canada voted once again to change the words of our national anthem politically correct, to a slightly more politically correct version. They're always tinkering with that anthem. As I close off each of these shows with the Maple Leaf Forever, which I consider Canada's real anthem. The words remain the same. The sentiments are uplifting and patriotic, and they're not constantly being altered to the whims of political correctness, which is what has happened here. Sons versus all of us. Canada's national anthem now gender neutral. O Canada, the country's national anthem since 1980, will become more women-friendly after Canadian MPs overwhelmingly voted to replace the words and all thy sons command, with the words, and all of us command. The gender debate truly reached a new level as the Canadian Senate adopted a bill on Wednesday, January the 31st, to amend the second line of the national anthem. Changing the words from "and all thy sons command" to "and all of us command." The bill introduced by Liberal MP Maurice Bélanger maintains that changing the lyrics of the English version would make it gender neutral. A nation of neuters, that's about it. The bill must receive the royal assent from the Governor General, the representative of the British monarch in Canada, in order to officially become the law. But that is a foregone conclusion. The role of the Governor General is almost entirely symbolic. The current wording of O Canada has existed since 1908, when poet Robert Stanley Weir translated the French lyrics. Since then, the lyrics have been changed several times. To move with the times. Since then, the lyrics have been changed twice. Once in 1913. I'm having some problems with my screen here. Once in 1913, over several decades, there have been other attempts to amend nearly every line of Canada's short anthem. In the early 1990s, the Toronto City Council proposed the words, our home, and I'm really having a lot of trouble with this screen here. Proposed the words "our home and native land" should be changed to "our home and cherished land," arguing that non-native Canadians may feel discriminated against and stigmatized. Talk about the land of a wimp. Also, religious references, namely the English line "God keep our land glorious and free," and the French words "true cross," have been criticized by secularist groups. You see, people want to, there's a small faction who simply want to change the country, who simply want to erase all of our history. And that's, of course, what we saw earlier this week, or at least an example of it, with the decision by a 12-4 vote of the Halifax City Council to remove the statue of the founder of the city, Lord Cornwallis, because some Indians objected, Native Indians. You don't change your country's history. I mean, it is what it is. Now, of course, you can move on from that history. Times change and so on, but to denigrate your history, It makes you a nation of lost souls. Anyway, back to Canada's national anthem. Gender has increasingly become a policy issue since the current Liberal government, led by the trust fund kid Justin Trudeau, took power. Last summer, it was decided that there's a provision of a third gender on our country's ID and immigration documents. Immigration, Refugee and Citizenship Canada will be the first government agency to introduce interim measures that allow passport holders to indicate a third gender, male, female, or mixed up. last July, Canada's British Columbia, the province, issued the first ever unknown gender identity card to an 8-month-old baby after the child's parents fought to raise the infant gender free. This type of behavior, in my opinion, shows people with a very imperfect grasp of reality. I think it bodes ill for our country's future. Well, I mentioned this trial in Winnipeg, Manitoba, of an individual who had is accused of murdering a 15-year-old Indian girl named Tina Fontaine. Now, this murder has become quite notorious. She had run away several times from her reservation. She had a difficult life, and I don't envy her, and I don't deny that she'd had pressures. But she also had people who cared for her and loved her. Her great aunt had raised her and her sister after her family fell apart. And still the young girl chose to leave the reservation several times to go to the big city. She's like only 14 when this started. She was dead at 15. She ran away and got involved with drugs and alcohol and prostitution. Let's not be too coy about it. And was brought back several times to the reservation, ran away again, and finally the great aunt thought perhaps child services could have more control over it. And what they did was put her in a residential hotel. She continued to hang out with questionable characters and was murdered, and her body fished out of the Assiniboine River. Very sad story. Of course, this is being used as a great opportunity to whip white Canadians with guilt. Now, here's one of the big guilt mongers, Denise Balcassoon. I don't know what her claim to fame is, but she's an occasional columnist for the Globe and Mail. She talked about the trial. And this is referring to Tina Fontaine. In pictures, her sweet face is plump, smooth, and painfully young. But Tina was never allowed to be innocent. Her life stained by the systemic prejudice and intergenerational trauma that relentlessly chases Indigenous people in Canada. What a crock of horse turds. So she was never allowed to be innocent. Her life stained by the systemic prejudice. Now, let's be quite clear. Her mother, named Duck, last name, soon after having children, went off to Winnipeg, became a complete whack job alcoholic, basically abandoned her kids. Now, is that systemic prejudice? No. Her father meant well, but he got cancer. Then had to give up the girls to the great aunt who took care of them. And then he was murdered by, let's be quite clear, by two fellow Indians after a drunken gathering. And both Indians are now being convicted of God, being sent to prison. And they said at their trial that they're very sorry and all that, but then they didn't have much of an explanation except they drank too much. Wasn't even quite sure what the dispute was. They were all friends. Now, I'd be the first to sympathize and agree that Tina Fontaine was handed an unfair burden in life, But she did have her foster, Velma Favell, who was her foster mother. But notice the effort to try to make whites feel guilty. But Tina was never allowed to be innocent because of systemic prejudice and intergenerational trauma. Intergenerational trauma. That relentlessly chases indigenous people in Canada. No, bad family raising skills. Irresponsible parents, not her father, but particularly, but the mother. Where's the girl's mother? She's off boozing and partying in Winnipeg. You know, it's that type of thing. And it's not our fault at all. Her mother had Tina as a teenager, then disappeared into alcohol abuse. Her father had terminal cancer, so Tina and her younger sister were raised largely by the great aunt Thelma Favell. Since Tina's death, her cousin Janine was shot and killed, while her brother Charles coped with his own demons using methamphetamines bought with the proceeds of sex work. Let's be quite blunt. Her own brother became a male prostitute. These are many of these are immoral, dysfunctional people. Her cousin, Janine was shot and killed, okay, by another Indian. Her brother Charles, has been using methamphetamines, bought with the proceeds of being a male prostitute. Now, to the extent these people end up poorly, much of this is their own fault. It was the beating death of her sick father, Eugene, which sent both teenagers down a dark spiral. Tina, who is Anishinaabe, she's Native Indian, you know, a member of the Sad King First Nation, began leaving Miss Favell's rural home for Winnipeg, in part to connect with her mother. And in doing so, connected with the world of drugs, alcohol, and she became a prostitute. Now, it was at the beating death of their sick father, Eugene. It would be helpful in presenting the whole picture if Miss Balcassoon, the author, acknowledged that he was beaten to death by two fellow Indians who were apparently his friends. And then farther down in the article, she says, multiple news outlets, including the paper she's writing for, The Globe, used headlines highlighting Nina's substance use without contextualizing it, that it was being scrutinized on the request of Mr. Cormier, the one whose actions are actually on trial. Drinking alcohol and smoking marijuana are common, after all, and that Tina was also getting high on prescription drugs only highlights how in need of help she was. Perhaps so. But you know, it brings up the difficult dilemma. She was only 14 years old when she started running off to Winnipeg, to a big city, and getting involved with smoking marijuana, alcohol, and eventually sex and prostitution. What could her great aunt, her guardian, do? You know, you can't chain the child down. She tried. She tried to counsel her. She even turned her over to Child Protective Services, which many people might think might not be a very good idea. With this nonsense, Denise Balcassoon says multiple news outlets highlighted Tina's substance use without contextualizing it. The context is she's 14, 15 years old. She died when she was 15. That is an extremely dangerous pursuit. Likely, or predictably, to lead to trouble, if not worse. Well, I don't take comfort in even socialists' problems, because I think they are reflective right now of an absolute madness. Madness having to do with sexual harassment. This poor NDP guy suddenly finds himself stripped of his role as on a committee in the House of Commons, no longer allowed to ask questions in the House of Commons. He's ostracized until there can be an investigation. Okay, fair enough. What's the poor fellow done? This guy's name is Weir. He's a socialist or NDP member of the House of Commons, elected from Regina Leven, the city of Regina. Okay. Well, again, what's the guy done? Well, the leader of the party, Jagmeet Singh, not kidding you, Jagmeet Singh, has suspended him from the party. And he's had to take represent the party in the House of Commons. He can't speak up. Now, what started all this? Here's a quotation. The idea is that we believe in survivor-led process, but just because we don't have a survivor, we don't have someone who's experienced harassment and is willing to come forward, it's my responsibility as leader, he means who is committed to creating a safe working space, to at least do something to examine or to look into any allegations which raise concerns about the workplace. Okay. This poor fellow, Weir, sent out a letter seeking support to be caucus chairman. Well, a feminist, a member of his own party, a member of parliament for Temiskaming, wrote back and circulated an email and this is what she said. In response to an email Weir sent to his caucus colleagues on Tuesday announcing his intention to run for the position of caucus chairman, Moore hit reply all, that's his member of parliament, of the same party, incidentally, saying he's the last person in the caucus I would like to see in that position. There is too many women, she means there are too many women, mostly employees, complaint, it's almost illiterate, complaint to me that you were harassing to them, and as a woman I would not feel comfortable to meet with you alone. Moore represents the Northern Quebec riding. Now, just listen to that. Now, this is a member of her own party, a fellow socialist. There are too many women who complained to me, I guess, that you were harassing to them, and as a woman, I would not feel comfortable to meet with you alone. It boggles the mind. Now, there's a 43, I think there are 43 members in the NDP caucus. Surely, since they were elected in the October 2015 election, Mr. Weir, at some point, has been alone, you know, maybe in a corner of a room or walking in the halls or whatever, with Miss Moore. But she says she would not feel comfortable to meet with you alone. To the extent that her illiterate email actually says anything, it says many women, mostly employees, complain to me that you were harassing them. Now, what is this poor guy supposed to do? The leader of his own party is prepared to throw him under the bus pending an investigation. And Jagmeet Singh, the party leader, admits there's no complainant. The dramatic term here, the idea that we believe in a survivor-led process. Survivor of, now sexual harassment can go all the way from something that's criminal, like rape or molesting something, to a sexy joke, a remark. It is so widely defined. And all these people are survivors. Now, I can understand a person being a survivor of rape. But if somebody made a joke, I hardly consider the person who heard the joke and may have been upset or offended a survivor. But it gets even richer. It's not even clear that it's about sex, whatever this harassment is. And this is what the party leader said. The idea is that we believe in survivor-led process. But just because we don't have a survivor. In other words, we don't have anybody even complaining. Hey, he did this to me. We don't have someone who's experienced harassment and is willing to come forward. It's my responsibility as a leader, that is, he means who is committed to creating a safe working space to at least do something to examine and to look into any allegations that raise concerns about the workplace. Well, why not look into those allegations to the extent they are even allegations here? Before he imposes a penalty on Mr. Weir. This is the sort of anti-male madness that is tearing apart the, I think, the fabric of Canada and the United States under the Me Too hashtag. And it's as color covers everything, you know, from a dirty. Here's a good example. Christy Blatchford is on this, and this is how ridiculous it can get. The letter, anonymous, of course, made it all sound quite egregious. The note dated last month was positively bristling with injury. The writer said that a male supervisor in the office, a lawyer by training, had sent a sexually explicit message about a female colleague's lingerie and had further encouraged all recipients of the email to approach the female colleague about it. Okay, sounds on the surface a little dicey. It was an example, the writer said, anonymous incidentally, of sexual harassment of each and every female employee at the at that particular organization, and worse, the organization has not taken action. Those victimized have not received an acknowledgement, an apology, or an offer of counseling for the abuse. Why, the writer said, the man must be sanctioned. He must be both fired and disciplined by the Law Society of Upper Canada. Okay, we certainly whet our curiosity. What exactly had happened? And Chrissy Blanchard is not identifying the the organization because it's a sort of accusation, just the accusation, that can be a career ender. Here's the background. On November 10th, a female manager was sent out a notice to employees on two particular floors with a list of winners attached and asked them to come and pick up their prizes. Last fall, the organization held its annual company-wide raffle of donated prizes with all proceeds going to a wonderful charity that employs developmentally handicapped people. About 20 minutes later, a male manager replied, also to everyone, and said, "Just to clarify, X," that's one of the employees, "secretly wanted the leopard print lingerie basket bustier and put my name in the hat so as not to appear greedy in winning that, and the roast lace chemise with black G-string, one size fits all with that. Congratulations, X," that's the employee. "You got both prizes you really wanted. Please congratulate her should you see her in the hallway. All in the name of a good cause," he said. Please note, they were real prizes in a real charity raffle. X, the recipient, confirmed that she did put his name in the hat for the bustier. She was absolutely mortified that someone had complained about the note. She took no offense at all. She told the Post in a short interview, "There was no offense to be taken. The man is a wonderful colleague," she said. "We're friends." She appeared worried now that this would somehow follow him. The man was aghast and shaken. He's fully supportive of his organization's anti-harassment policies. He repeated that several times. He didn't know if anyone had complained internally. The call from me was the first he'd heard. This is the sort of poisoned pen attack. And notice all the drama. The writer, of course, anonymous. And that's fine. So evil. Had complained that the organization had not taken action to help those victimized, did not receive an apology or counseling. Why would anybody need counseling? The writer was jesting that these were prizes that among others, that were used in this raffle to try to raise funds for hiring developmentally handicapped individuals, among them a leopard skin bustier and a rose lace chemise with black G-string. Okay, so the man who wrote the comments didn't initiate the prizes. The prize, and these were two among many, the prizes were clearly acceptable to men and women, and he was merely joking that the woman had put his name in for the leopard skin bustier, so it wouldn't be she wouldn't appear too greedy because she really wanted it, and shown it. Good, and there was no offense taken by anybody except some anonymous person who now apparently wants the fellow who's a lawyer fired, and perhaps even lose his license to practice after a complaint to the Law Society of Upper Canada. You know, we are in the realm of madness here. A political correct, but politically correct insanity. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. I'm going to take a short musical break here, and I'm going to play a couple of songs that I hope you like. And I am really having a little bit of trouble with our computers tonight here. And so if you will bear with me, and we can get this, hopefully, yeah, get this going. this is, of course, a song by the man who I love to play, and of course I've named his song, The Fighting Side of Me, is I've named this program after, and this is Merle Haggard and America First. And in so many ways, this typifies the battle that we are in, trying to overcome the traitors and the globalists who want to put others first. We want to put our countries first. This is Merle Haggard and America First. And this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the phone.
Listerine Total Care Zero, the most complete Listerine, without alcohol for a less intense taste.
That's Merle Haggard in America First. I'm going to play a song that's very typical of the late 1960s. This is a classic. Me and Bobby McGee with Kris Kristofferson.
Busted flat in Baton Rouge, heading for the train. Feeling nearly faded as my dream. Bobby phoned a diesel down just before it rained. Took us all the way to New Orleans. I pulled my harpoon out of my dirty red bandana, blew and sad while Bobby sang the blues. With them windshield wipers slapping time and Bobby clapping hands, he finally sang up every song that driving knew. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. nothing, but it's free. Feeling good was easy, Lord, when I sang the blues. Feeling good was good enough for me. Good enough for me and Bobby McGee. Set it right beside me, Lord, through everything I've known. Every night she kept me from the cold. And so when Miss Selena's Lord, I let her slip away.
Chris Christopherson and Friends, great classic from the 1960s. Me and Bobby McGee. Gonna play one more tune here. This is a kind of nice gospel song. Made popular in the mid 1970s by Chris Christopherson and June Carter Cash. The Far Side Banks of Jordan with Jimmy Fortune.
I believe my steps are growing wearier. Still I've got a journey on my mind. lures of this old world that seeks to make me want to stay. My one regret is leaving you behind, but I'll be waiting on the far side banks of Jordan. I'll be sitting drawing pictures in the sand, and when I see you coming, I will rise up with a shout and come running through the shallow waters, reaching for your hand. If it proves to be his will that I am first to cross, somehow I'll feel that it will be. When it comes your time to travel, likewise don't feel lost, for I will be the first one that you'll see. And I'll be waiting on the far side banks of Jordan, sitting drawing pictures in the sand, and when I see you coming, I will rise up with a shout and come running through the shallow waters, reaching for your hand. Through this life we've labored hard to earn our meager fare. It's brought us trembling hands and failing eyes. So I'll just rest here on this shore and turn my eyes away until you come and we'll see paradise. But I'll be waiting on the far side banks of Jordan. I'll be sitting drawing pictures in the sand, and when I see you coming, I will rise up with a shout and come running through the shallow waters, reaching for your hand. And I'll be waiting on the far side banks of Jordan. I'll be sitting drawing pictures in the sand, and when I see you coming, I will rise up with a shout and come running through the shallow waters, reaching for your hand. And I'll be running through the shallow waters, reaching for your hand.
Jimmy Fortune and nice as Ron Events it is, I will play that another night. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on lightresistanceradio.com. another aspect of the mania about sexual harassment is a blow-up just last week. I'm recording this Friday night. Just 8 days ago, Patrick Brown, the leader of the Progressive Conservative Party of Ontario, under tremendous pressure, stepped down after there was accusations from two anonymous women, who are now in their late 20s, who said that when they were 18 and 19, in several instances, that he behaved in a, I would say, pretty forward way to them. Now, he didn't rape them, and when they asked him to stop his attentions, he did. In one case, drove the girl home. Okay. Well, the minute these accusations were made, anonymously, on the media, his entire caucus turned against him and demanded that he step down. He denies the charges, but he did step down. His closest advisors, whom he'd appointed, quit. Anyway, well, he does have some friends. And Joseph Villeneuve, who acted for the Tories in at least one court case, he's a lawyer, posted a number of comments and articles on Facebook questioning the credibility of a woman who says Brown forced himself on her when she was a teenager, and of the TV networks that first reported the charges. Brown resigned over the issue, but has strenuously denied accusations. Quote, I see a pattern of innuendo and allegations masquerading as truth despite no court proceedings, Villeneuve wrote on Facebook. Well, now that seems, certainly the man's opinion. Villeneuve was a friend of Patrick Brown's from law school. Ali Khan Velshi, chief of staff to interim conservative leader Vic Fedeli, called the senior partner in Villeneuve's law firm, Zuber and Company, within minutes of learning about the Facebook post on Thursday, announcing he was canceling the firm's retainer. The party said it would also forward the social media entries to the Law Society of Upper Canada, which regulates lawyers in this province. This is vile, a party spokesman said, asking not to be named. I laugh. I mean, they want to destroy this fellow Villeneuve's legal standing, or standing with the Law Society of Upper Canada, but don't use my name. I mean, I shouldn't laugh. This is just hideous, and all he's doing is saying that that these charges are innuendo and allegations masquerading as truth. And here's another interesting little tidbit. He also referred to reports that the woman is a former work colleague and friend of Rachel Aiello, one of the CTV reporters who reported the story. I think the public deserves to know when a reporter is in a close relationship with an anonymous source. It doesn't pass the smell test. Frankly, there seems to be an intentional or negligent attempt to mislead about the fact that they were acquainted for years before this disclosure. Fairness dictates that disclaimer. And I think that's true. And that kind of puts a different shine on it. And also puts the shine of perhaps electoral opportunism as we're going into a provincial election. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. And I sign off tonight very proudly, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the make-believe forever.